Exodus chapter 1 all the way through on page 45 of the Bibles. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." Well, over to Chris.
Let me add my welcome to Tom. It's really good to see you here. I know there are a few here for the first time. Particular welcome to you. It's nice to have you with us today. Let's start with the coronavirus. It's interesting, isn't it, the way it sort of grabbed the world's attention. It certainly seems to be on the front pages of all the newspapers and all the news feeds that I look at. I think there are many who are genuinely scared, unsure what's going to happen next. And I think one of the biggest challenges is finding reliable information. Who do we listen to? Who can we take at their word? Unusually, Wikipedia has had to introduce editing locks to prevent the malicious spread of misinformation and exaggerated claims. Apparently, there was at one point where something like 60 or 80 million people had read misinformation, which had originated on a Wikipedia site. And of course, the concerns are multiplying. It's no longer just the virus, but many of the issues that have sort of spun out of the virus, such as xenophobia and racism and loss of business and that sort of thing. The whole matter is alarming at many levels. Will there be a coronavirus pandemic, or will it be contained? There's one chap that seems to be speaking out about this quite regularly. He's called Dr. Zhong Nashan. And he is the top scientist on respiratory illness in China. And at the moment, he's leading the Chinese government-appointed panel of experts, which are there to supposedly control the outbreak. Some feel he's just a puppet of the Chinese government. No idea. But he certainly has the attention of the Chinese people. And many of the news feeds that we read seem to be picking up the sort of the rhetoric that he puts out there. And he has remained optimistic, it's interesting, about the demise of the virus, saying that the worst may very soon be behind us. 9 days ago, he said, no, sorry, that was true yesterday. 10 days ago, he said that the virus would peak in 10 to 14 days. And 5 days ago, he said that it may indeed be that the peak is just around the corner and already reported cases are in decline. Now, I don't know, some of the headlines I've seen today may throw doubt on that. Anyway, the question is raised, can we take Dr. Nashan? He is the world expert on this stuff, apparently. Can we take him at his word? Does he know what he's talking about? Well, who knows? We can watch over the next few days and find out. But you see, taking somebody at his word is of vital importance. That is the issue that we must have at the forefront of our minds as we turn to the book of Exodus. You see, taking God at his word is everything as we enter into the story of the Exodus. Words, especially words of promise, can be very hard to believe. And even more so when the world around us looks like it's collapsing. Can God's promises be trusted? Can God's promises be trusted? And you'll see that brings us to the first point there on the handout. God has promised great things. God has promised great things. Now, the openings of books in the Bible are always important. And the first seven verses are written to remind us of the story so far. In fact, in the original language, if you were to look at a Hebrew Bible, you would find that the very first word in the book of Exodus is the word "and." Now, Moses probably wrote Genesis and Exodus and a few books afterwards, and he obviously hadn't done GCSE English because he'd know that you weren't meant to start a sentence with the word "and." And so I think that's why some of our editors take it out, because it sounds a bit cumbersome. But of course, he had very good literary reason to put the word "and" in there, because he wanted to connect the book of Exodus with everything written before in the book of Genesis. So really, what we should be reading is, "and these were the names." That's how the book starts. "And these were the names." So there we are, connected to Genesis. Why does he want to do that? Well, he wants to connect us with the plot so far. The plot so far. God had spoken significantly to Abraham and to a few of his sons and said, "I'm going to absolutely make sure, I'm going to promise you." Well, I've summed up the promise in three headlines there. You'll see them on the handout again. People, land, blessing. Abraham, you are going to have people as numerous as the stars in the sky, the grains of sand on the seashore. Huge, notable, reliable people. And a wonderful land. A land that you will own forever. And blessing. Abraham, I will give you incredible blessing. I will bless you and I will look after you. And actually, you'll even be a blessing to other people. Significant promises to make. And that's what we're meant to be thinking about as we enter the book of Exodus. Now, again, the opening few verses begin to sort of set the scene and the narrative. The old guard, Joseph and his brothers, they were the last guys that we heard about in the book of Genesis. Well, they all die off pretty soon in the opening verses. And a new generation is born. And this generation is strong. Have a look at verse 7. The people of Israel were fruitful and they increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now, if we're meant to have all the promises of Genesis in our mind, then you can see things are looking pretty good by the time we get to verse 7. God said to Abraham, you're going to have descendants as many as the stars in the sky, the grains of sand on the seashore. Verse 7, the land was filled. And so, by verse 7, as readers of Exodus, we can say, yeah, God has spoken. He's made promises. It looks like some of that promise is coming true. We can take him at his word. But what about the land? I mean, there was good reason for God's people entering Egypt because of the famine back at the end of Genesis. But that's not the land that they were promised. So there's a bit of a question mark over the land. And as for blessing, well, when they first arrived, they did receive the incredible blessing of their host, the Pharaoh, the king. But things have changed. That old generation aren't around anymore. Neither is that Pharaoh. And it could be that we jump 350 years between verse 7 and verse 8. And so there's a massive, massive change, a regime change. Everything changes in that time. All the heroes of Abraham and Jacob and Joseph, the patriarchs as they're sometimes called, they're all dead. They're long gone. Stories about the great things that God had done They're just distant memories now. And the distant memories were obviously recorded as history. But you know what things are like. I mean, 350 years ago, that's a long time ago with things going on in London. It's all old-fashioned and black and white. Things were very different back then. History, well, it turns to legend. And legend turns to myth, and myth is very quickly forgotten. That brings us to the second point. Promises can be hard to believe. Look at verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many, too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Now the new Pharaoh, he doesn't understand or respect the past. He feels threatened by the increased numbers and he quickly resorts to damage control. God's people are in his sights. Tyrannical measures quickly escalate. Look at verse 11. Taskmasters afflict them with heavy burdens. They're forced to build cities for Pharaoh. They become objects of hatred in the Egyptians' eyes. Look at verse 12. At the end, we read, the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, of the Hebrews. That means the Egyptians developed a pathological hatred for anything to do with the Israelites. They despised them. They were social outcasts. Worse, by verse 13, slaves. Verse 14, their lives were bitter. I guess if we'd started pretty optimistic with all the great explosion of people, by the time we get to verse 14, with bitter lives, we're thinking, wait a second, that doesn't sound very blessed. And I think as readers, that's exactly what's meant to happen. We're meant to get to this point in the book of Exodus and say, that's not right. This is not how it should be. I remember what God said, and this is a far cry from what God told me. Now, by this stage in Egypt, there were probably a million Israelites living in slavery. And so Pharaoh has to introduce some pretty drastic measures to deal with such a large number. Verse 15, it becomes very personal. Pharaoh approaches two of the Hebrew midwives, and he tries to win their allegiance. You can imagine him, can't you, sort of slipping alongside on his sort of camel train or whatever it would have been into the little sort of Hebrew hospital, whatever their makeshift slavery sort of type hospital was. And then look at verse 15. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah, the other Phua, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." It's quite a conversation to have had, isn't it? Now, wonderfully, at this stage, Pharaoh's efforts fail. And the midwives display remarkable courage. I'm going to come back to the midwives a little bit later on. But for now, it's just worth noting that their act of bravery, and it is a notable act of bravery, actually makes things much worse. Just look at where it ends up. Look at how the narrative progresses. Glance down at verse 22. Okay, because the midwives didn't do what Pharaoh said, verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile." That is an incredible thing to give the people permission, command to do, isn't it? Can you imagine what it must have been like for God's people back then? What the average Hebrew family must have gone through? I mean, living in a world where at any moment your newborn baby boy might legally be ripped from your arms by any member of the Egyptian public. Imagine with that backdrop, having the responsibility of having to pass God's words on, God's words of promise to the next generation. Imagine having to say, as families were being decimated, "We believe in a great God, a God who's made amazing promises, a God who's promised to bless us and to keep us." Can you imagine having that responsibility? How can you say we have a great God who is going to bless us as the people you are speaking to are having their children legally murdered? I mean, picture the small Hebrew household. Here's a random house with mum, dad, and three daughters. Now, it would have been mum, dad, three daughters, and two sons. They tried hard to hide the sons from the authorities. But once Pharaoh changed the law and made it legal for any member of the Egyptian public, well, they couldn't last any longer. The small boys were snatched from their hands, never seen again. And you can imagine the daughters saying, did God, mum and dad, did God really make those promises? Are you telling me, mum, that you believe in a God that actually has promised us blessing? To us, it just doesn't seem like God exists. And dad, quite frankly, if he does exist, it really looks like he doesn't care. As we look back, as we sort of think about, you know, where this sort of grates, where this connects for us, I mean, this type of hostility against God's people, you'll probably think of a number of times in history, in far history and more recent history, where there are connections. Some well-known examples. I mean, in 1949, the communists seized power in China. And the Western world despaired, not knowing what was going to happen to the church. The church, Christian church in China in 1949 was relatively young. It had only been going for a few decades at that stage. Perhaps 700,000 Christians, the estimates suggest. What was going to happen as the communists came in and closed the doors and the West no longer had access? The 1970s, the church in Cambodia was only about 50 years old when the Khmer Rouge took over. And the Khmer Rouge declared Cambodian Christians enemies of the state. And they hunted them down. And what about for us now? I mean, I don't think it's fair to say we experience this sort of blatant oppression. But it does come in more subtle ways sometimes, doesn't it? The gentle erosion of freedom. It can be really hard sometimes to actually express what we believe about our Christian faith. It's so easy to be completely captivated, completely transfixed, completely terrified about what others think. That forces us to keep our views to ourselves. I mean, think about the people in your office, the people perhaps that you work around. And people will speak openly about the most incredible subjects, and with great authority sometimes, but very rarely about Christian things. It can be very scary, can't it, to actually speak openly about what we believe about the Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, again, the pathological hatred that we read about here, it's quite rare in our world, but to be looked down on, to be sidelined, to be despised, I mean, that's the sort of language we can relate to. And I guess we're just so used to living in a society which has no respect for Christian values and has no respect or interest in the gospel. And at times like these, I think it's very easy, isn't it, to be exactly on message here. God's promises can be very hard to believe when there's very little evidence of anybody around us taking them seriously. And as we think about this, well, it's not just the words of promise that come under scrutiny, but it's the integrity of the person that says those words. You see, the promises of God and the character of God are inseparably bound. So that raises the question, if we can't see evidence of God's promises taking grip, can we trust God? And I'm sure that's a sentiment that we can relate to. Are you really there, God? And if you are there, do you really care? Can't you see what's going on? I mean, how many times have you sort of felt that? Now, God, would be a great time to act. This particular hardship, this particular difficulty, this isn't helping me, this isn't helping you, God. Now would be good. But you see, as readers of Exodus, we are meant to have another perspective as we read through all of this chapter. You see, there is a ray of hope. I've given you a taste of that, but just follow it through with me again. Here is the ray of hope. Here is the reality of what God is doing. Verse 7, the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. Verse 12, the more they were oppressed, here's a bit of a surprise, the more they multiplied. the more they spread abroad. And verse 20, so God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. Now, I seriously doubt that God's people on the ground going through this horrendous time in history, I doubt that they remembered this at the time. I doubt they really realized this. But as readers, well, we have a different perspective. We can see God at work through the mess. And this is often the case, of course, as we look back. I have no doubt that for those people in China back in 1949 when the communists seized power, and I know for the people in Cambodia, I mean, they experienced the most horrendous times. But God used those times for, I think it's fair to say, church explosion. I mean, when the West did get back into China, when the communists allowed the West back in, the estimates more recently have been that there are 80 million Christians in China. 700,000 when the communists came to power. Huge difficulty. 80 million the other side. In Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge managed to pick off pretty much all of the mature church leadership. But the church in Cambodia is strong today. Now, if you've been brought along today, there may well be people who've been brought along, perhaps first time to the talks or just looking into the Christian faith. Then I want to ask you the question, what do you make of a God like this? As Christians, we believe in a God who keeps his promises, even through times of despair and difficulty. And amazingly, can even use those times to bring about a blessing that we don't necessarily anticipate or understand at the time. I'd suggest that this is a God that's worth taking seriously. This is a God that works in ways that don't immediately make sense to us. Well, just as we sort of draw to close, I mean, how should this be applied more specifically? You see, in our day-to-day experience, we may not see much evidence of God keeping his promises. But you see, Christian hope should never be based on our experience of what we see, but instead on God, on his character, and on what he has said, on what he has promised. That was what the people then needed to hold on to, even as their world collapsed around them. God is faithful. He can be trusted. When he speaks, he acts. And that's what the book of Exodus is all about. God acting on promises. In the opening chapter, God's people had no choice but to hold on to what he said. And we do see a wonderful little case study of two individuals who absolutely hold on to what God says. Let's just close with this great little bit of application. We see this modeled in the midwives. Can I just say a little aside? Every time I read anything about midwives, it always reminds me when I was at school, I had to fill in one of those career forms, you know, when you fill in sort of 100 questions, which gives you a very detailed expert opinion on how you're going to profitably spend your time and your career. Well, I filled mine in. I did mine carefully. Some of my friends just sort of joked around and didn't do it carefully. I did mine carefully. And the result was I should have been a midwife. So that was unusual. And I was sharing this with somebody the other day. I was actually sitting at dinner with some friends, with Tom Bernardo, the chap on the door that many of you will know. And he said, well, that's nothing. I was told I should be an undertaker. So I thought that was quite good. Anyway, look at the midwives. Look at verse 17. The midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. Verse 21. The midwives feared God. They're commended for their fear. Now, I think it's easy to get hung up. Did they lie to Pharaoh? That's not the point. Discussions about whether or not they lied is not the point. The point that they are commended for, the one attribute that the text draws your attention to twice, they feared the Lord. That's the point that we need to hold on to. And that is an amazing thing, given that the full weight of the secular authorities was bearing down on them. I guess they found that pretty terrifying. Pharaoh came to visit them personally. Who knows what he promised them or what he threatened them with? And yet we're told twice, they feared the Lord, not Pharaoh. I think that's quite helpful as we think about application, isn't it? I mean, a healthy, commendable fear of the Lord is the only way to make sense of it all. What would that look like for us as we think about our workplaces? I mean, it's going to be slightly different for each one of us, but to be so focused on what God has said, on what God has promised, on who God is, that we can sit more lightly to people who make unreasonable demands. Verse 17, did not do as the king of Egypt commanded. Unreasonable demands of your boss? Unreasonable demands of the HR department that fly in the face of what our king, the Lord Jesus, has commanded? I mean, imagine having such an admiration for what God has told us will be, that we trust him no matter what happens. Tom mentioned as he opened this meeting, this questions for life. The flyers are not on your tables, they're actually at the back. You will have heard lots about this. Questions for life, a particularly good opportunity to be introducing friends and colleagues to the Lord Jesus. Lots of people put on events in their offices. They invite one of us to come and speak and just explain the gospel over a cup of tea or a plate of sandwiches, something like that. Why don't you think seriously about doing that? Don't worry about HR. If they say no, you can come and do it here. Imagine not worrying about what your colleagues thought. Imagining not worrying about what impact it might have, apart from knowing that we were acting in line with a God who has made wonderful promises. Confidence in him. Be great, wouldn't it? New ambitions, a new possibility to take on risks we'd never considered. Because actually, to put our lot in with this God is no risk at all. Well, there's a few things to think about as we close. Thanks for joining us as we open Exodus. We'll carry on next week, but for now I'm going to hand straight back to Tom. Tom, over to you.